Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwen Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest today, Cynthia Reyes. Cynthia, you've had a very successful career in film and television as a producer. Did you write the scripts for the programs you produced?
Often, almost always, except when I became an executive producer, then I was editing and commissioning content. But almost always, I think I've always written. Writing, actually, for me, for television, was one of the most challenging things I've ever done. Because, you know, there's this whole sense that it has to be focused enough, mm-hmm. it has to be simple enough and yet beautiful enough and factual, that if it's journalism, that people will understand and remember and it'll have meaning to them.
It's quite a tall order.
Yeah, you can't. Now you can go back because everything is on the internet, but you couldn't go back at the time. So for me, it was a lifelong challenge to write in a way that would be understandable and be clear and have meaning to the listeners and the viewers. And in a way, I think my writing, a lot of people read my book and my stories to other people.
Right.
Children, adult children read them to parents. Parents read parts to children. Husbands and wives read it to each other. And I think it's because of all that writing for television.
Where you had to please the wide audience.
Yes, and also write clearly and succinctly and at the same time hook people into being interested in what you're talking about.
Where did you begin your career in film? And
So I began my career at the CBC after graduating from Ryerson, and I have a little story that kind of shows that even when you're a journalist and you think you're the most observant person in the world, things can really just knock you off your feet and really surprise you. Should I read this little part to you?
Yes, that'd be lovely.
It's called A Good Time. So here goes. And so it was that, fresh out of journalism school, I became a trainee reporter in the CBC's TV News Summer Trainee Program in Toronto. It was a great honor, awarded to only 6 journalism graduates from all the J schools in the country. After a few weeks' intensive training, most of us would be shipped off to various cities across the country for the 4 months of late spring and summer. One would stay in Toronto. I begged the CBC executives to let me be that one. Toronto had become my home city. Or at least to send me to romantic Montreal where I could use my French. But the CBC brass had other ideas. You need to develop a sense of Canada, they pointed out, especially since you're an immigrant. And so they sent me as far away as possible, to Vancouver. Going to faraway places didn't frighten me. After all, only a few years earlier, I'd left my homeland on 2 weeks' notice and come to Canada to live. But Vancouver's reputation, despite its vaunted natural charms, was not encouraging. In Vancouver, they're laid back to the point of being comatose, a senior journalist in Toronto warned, and they're not nice to people from the East. Even worse, CBC TV in Vancouver had a scary history with young summer trainee journalists sent from Toronto. Seems the newsroom liked to eat them alive. What would they make of me in Vancouver? I was from the East, worse. I was a walking advertisement for everything rare in Canadian newsrooms. Brown skin, a Spanish last name, traces of a Jamaican accent at a time when English-Canadian newsrooms barely tolerated a French-Canadian or Newfoundland accent on the air. I was also a young woman. As I packed my suitcase and prepared to head west, my emotions swung between gung-ho determination and total fear. I arrived in Vancouver, checked in at the YWCA's hostel downtown, freshened up, and mulled over all that advice from the CBC training department. Get to know the city as quickly as possible, they had told me. Go walk about, meet people, ask questions. No time like the present, I thought. So, wearing no makeup, hair pulled back in a ponytail, I went out to learn about Vancouver. I had gone barely a block when a handsome, clean-cut young man wearing tennis gear and carrying a racket sauntered up to me. "Want to have a good time?" he asked with a friendly smile. "What do you mean, have a good time? What? Where?" "Wherever you want. My place isn't too far away." "How much?" "How much what? How much do you charge? For what? A good time." comprehension dawned on both of us at the same time. Suddenly, the young man was blushing, stammering, apologizing profusely. "I'm a TV news reporter," I said sternly, the first time I'd been able to say those words. They sounded marvelous.
So let's get back to the book. Perhaps you'll tell us how it came to be written.
Well, I'd been writing my whole life. For as long as I can remember, I wrote. I'd been keeping journals and writing short stories, often memoir-style stories, sometimes fiction, but mostly nonfiction. And I think for me it was a way of making sense of things in a very hectic life, especially after I moved to Canada. And things were just moving really fast. So I worked full-time and I went to university full-time. I always did volunteer work. And then I'm out in Vancouver and I'm here and I'm there and I'm everywhere. And my career was like that. And so I would find myself on a train or a plane or in a hotel room or something and be writing late at night about something that had happened that day. Years later, I had a bad accident. I could not speak to you as I'm speaking now. Somewhere in there, I developed a really bad stutter, and I had really bad memory problems, and I actually still do. So my husband one day thought he needed to remind me of who I was. Because I was literally at home. I never went out except to the hospital and occasionally to church. And he went looking for the stories. Then a magazine editor heard about the stories, Arabella magazine, and asked if they could publish one. Readers responded really well, and then after a while, readers started to say, well, does she have a book? We'd like to read if she's got a book. So my husband thought, this is a great idea. You've got enough stories here to make a book. Mm-hmm. And so over the next, I guess it was 2 years, with the help of three different editors and a lot of readers, I was able to put together a book that told a story about home and the search for home, the loss of home, the finding home. And that's what a good home is about, and that's how the book was written.
Oh, what a lovely story in itself.
Thank you.
And in the first segment, you read us a piece of Home in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Is there a piece in your book that is Home in Canada?
Yes. And in fact, I've had a few different homes in Canada, mm-hmm. but this is a farmhouse that belonged to my husband's family. And in Warkworth, that I'm going to tell you about. So we became the caretakers of it, our family. We lived and worked in the city. Our kids went to school in Toronto. And then every weekend and every holiday, we were in Warkworth. So here goes. Over the next several months, our family life continued as it had before. Two children in school. A happy marriage. Two busy careers. Community service, time spent with family, lots of school homework and lots of housework, paying the mortgage every month end. Hamlin and I had also become loving caretakers of a farm owned by his relatives in Warkworth, an hour and a half east of Toronto. We grabbed the opportunity, grateful that our children would have the chance to experience country life. Every Friday evening, we packed children, pet dog, toys, food, and ourselves into the car, drove the 90 minutes, unpacked in a hurry, stoked up the old wood stove, and shivered under blankets while the farmhouse warmed up. And then our weekend life would begin. In our previous visits to the village, we had never encountered another black family. But we had been warned that some country folk did not take kindly to weekenders, and we shouldn't take it personally. "This is the kind of village," said one longtime weekender, "where it takes 12 years before they invite you to join the hockey team, but 20 years before they pass you the puck." I gave a silent prayer of thanks that my family didn't play hockey and decided to keep an open mind. We took to the countryside like ducks to water. The children marveled at the star-filled night sky, the trees that seemed to be everywhere, the streams and ponds on many properties we passed. The long country roads dotted by old Ontario farmhouses built of red brick or white board and batten trimmed with green shutters and doors. The four of us were always delighted by the bounty of vegetables and fruit left for sale on stands by the roadside in front of farmers' houses. Even more intriguing was the honor system that the absent farmers used to conduct business while they tended their fields or livestock or took a trip into town, leaving their market stands unsupervised. A simple sign, usually handwritten on brown cardboard, told you the price of things. You picked up the quantity of tomatoes or beets or cucumbers or corn that you wanted and dropped your payment through a slit in the plastic lid of a coffee can. It was as if it had never occurred to either the farmers or their customers that someone could simply pick up the can of money and the produce and walk away. I also appreciated the down-to-earth ways of our neighbors and the expressions they used. After all, I too came from a place where people often spoke in proverbs and metaphors. "That guy was three sheets to the wind," I overheard a woman say, describing someone who'd gotten himself totally drunk at a local event. "I tell you, she was only half a sandwich short of a picnic," said our friend Joyce about a woman she claimed was crazy. "It was an all-out Donnybrook," said Ron, our neighbor from two farms over, as he reported to us on a fistfight that turned into a brawl at a recent dance. And then, when you least expected it, along came a touch of true elegance. The pork producer's ball turned out to be the same thing our friends John and Jane had mentioned when they called to invite us to the pig farmer's dance, and it was indeed elegant. The beautiful lady in fancy dress who waved us over with a brilliant smile was none other than Jane. John, whom I'd only ever seen wearing rugged coveralls while driving his tractor or mucking out the strong-smelling pig barn, walked up to us wearing a well-cut suit and minutes later waltzed me across the floor in a movement as light as a feather in a gentle breeze. During the summer holidays, our children took care of one of the neighbor's pigs and later adopted three goslings who quickly became full-grown geese with personalities of their own. Hamlin named them Huey, Dewey, and Louie, and we all swore that they smiled whenever Nikisha and Lauren showed up with their buckets of grain to feed them. Weekends and holidays in the country, weekdays in the city. It was a harmonious balance between town and country, and we were grateful for it.
That was delightful. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it is my privilege.
Where can listeners buy your book?
Well, they can get it on Amazon.ca, Chapters Indigo. There may still be some in bookstores here in either Port Hope or Cobourg. Okay. I'm not sure. They can contact me, cynthia.reyes@rogers.com, if they're having trouble, and I'll help them get copies.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in today. We hope you'll join us again next week. And in the meantime, if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions of who we might interview in future programs, please write to us at wordonthehills@gmail.com.